Thank you for downloading the Pawneeville Ranch podcast, brought to you by the staff of the Pawneeville Ranch. Welcome to the Pawneeville Ranch podcast. I'm Anna Davis, Pawneeville Ranch historical interpreter.
And I'm Hannah Wilson, Pawneeville Ranch intern.
So Halloween is upon us once again, which means we turn our podcast into a spook fest. If you're a longtime listener, you've heard our other Halloween topics, such as the Buffalo Park Sanatorium and the mysterious death of Dr. William Moore and our ghost painting. So for October, it gets pretty spooky up here with our fall festivals and our ghost stories events. But we decided to turn our podcast into one about a murder today. I want everybody to take a second and think back to their high school literature class. We're listening to boring lectures, we're reading classics that you've probably never picked up since, maybe you didn't even read it the first time. And I want you to think back to the great American novel, The Great Gatsby, because The Great Gatsby is literally this story tonight.
And if you were asleep during English Lit, we'll catch you up. 1920s, lots of partying, and a little bit of murder.
Yeah.
At the end.
The famous quote from The Great Gatsby, a little party never hurt nobody. Well, we will prove that a party can hurt some people. And we like to think that F. Scott Fitzgerald's book was a fantastic work of fiction, but we have a story for you today.
Oh, yeah. So what happens when you add together a little concoction that I like to say is one part murder, couple parts kidnapping, toss in some illegal drugs, some alcohol, some rich teenagers with their powerful fathers, and what do you get? You get one of the highest profile cases ever heard of in Pawnee County. So this is the infamous Society Gang killing of 1934. It's also known as a Reefer Madness killing, which
is... we're going to talk about some marijuana.
The High Hat Murder, or simply the Kinnamer Murder, named after the main player in our story, Philip, or as I will call him, Phil Kinnamer.
Yeah, so this is a story that I have had in, like, my back pocket for probably 3 years
We've
now.
We've been boiling on, like, when do we drop this?
I love this story. It is absolute insanity at its highest peak, so I hope that you really enjoy this, because, like I said, I've been saving this for a while. And you might ask us, well, how does this connect to Pawneeville? Like, what is the connection to our history? And this all goes back to an obscure photograph that we have in our archive. So one day, while I was flipping through some folders of photographs, I came across one picture of an elderly Pawneeville sharing a cigarette with a young man on what looks like some courthouse steps. Mm-hmm. And this photograph is obviously shot by a newspaper because it has a typewritten caption on the back that reads, Pawneeville having a talk with Kinnamer before his prison sentence began in McAllister, Oklahoma. Which is all kinds of confusing. So why is he with this young man? Why is this young man going to the penitentiary at McAllister? And both men are, like, in the picture. They're smiling at each other. They're sharing a cigarette.
Having a fun time.
Yeah, they're having a fun time. They're at ease with each other. So my interest was immediately piqued. I mean, you got to think about Pawneeville's life, about the people that he hung out with, and it's not odd to think that he probably knew people who went to prison or jail at some point in their lives. So
yeah, but he went to McAllister.
Like, yeah, this kid goes to the penitentiary, the big prison in McAllister. So there was just something about this whole scenario that I wanted to learn more about, and so this story made national news. Mm-hmm. It was a big deal, and it is, I know we say this a lot on the podcast, but this is one of the craziest crime stories I think I have ever heard.
Yes, and we've heard a lot of crazy crime stories, but I mean, 1920s and 1930s in America was crazy enough. I mean, here in the state of Oklahoma, men who had previously been absolutely dirt poor oil well workers were suddenly multimillionaires and honestly didn't really know what to do with all of that new wealth. We as a nation had just struggled through the Great Depression, and Prohibition had just ended in 1933. Times, especially for the children of the newly rich in Tulsa, were wild and plentiful, and they were kind of bored. And this isn't high school house drinking parties where a couple people pull up a keg and you get kind of wild.
No, we'll tell you exactly what they were doing later on, and it is insane.
No, this was hard living, hard drinking, living fast, dying young. This was just bored rich kids with too much time on their hands.
Exactly.
And too much money on their hands. This has shades of the infamous Leopold and Loeb case, which some of you may have heard of. Same situation, rich bored kids, nothing else to do. And the kind of, like we talked about, the fantasy of F. Scott Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald.
Extortion plots, kidnapping plots, things like that were not uncommon in Oklahoma, especially as people became rich through oil. Mm-hmm. It happened a lot, Oklahoma City, Tulsa especially, maybe.
But I don't know if that, like, it just keeps escalating.
Story just keeps escalating. So, I mean, this is... And this case has a lot of firsts in it, as you'll find out. So we will be discussing the infamous Kinnamer murder today on this podcast. But before we get to that, let's take a brief look at a moment in Pawneeville history.
This is Hannah Wilson with your look at a moment in Pawneeville history. On October 13, 1910, the Pawnee Courier-Dispatch released a story talking about the good deeds being done at the Buffalo Park Sanatorium by a new doctor called William Moore. Dr. Moore had been hired by Pawneeville to come from New Brunswick, New Jersey, to open a state-of-the-art hospital here in the town of Pawnee. The article has tied a record of good work. Quote, "The last few weeks have contained busy days for the Buffalo Park Sanatorium. Dr. Moore and four nurses have had all they could do. Among the more recent cases disposed of in this growing and popular institution are the following. Miss Gordon W. Lilly, who was operated on for appendicitis and other troubles. Her friends are glad to see her restored to perfect health. Miss Sadie Spurgeon, a teacher at Ralston, was operated on for appendicitis last week and is back home at work and school. Another appendicitis patient is Mrs. Lothan, who is home and well. Mrs. M.F. Ingram was taken to the hospital Monday, and on Tuesday, a large malignant tumor was removed from her. Mrs. Ingram is getting along nicely and laughingly says she's ready to go home now. Mrs. Sutton, a Pawnee Indian, had her appendix removed and gallbladder drained. Mr. Davis of New Brunswick, New Jersey, was operated on yesterday morning for kidney trouble. During the last 2 months, there have been 30 operations for appendicitis alone and not a case lost, which speaks well for the physicians and patients. Buffalo Park Sanatorium is an institution of which Pawnee is justly proud," end quote. Dr. Moore would serve as a doctor of the Buffalo Park Sanatorium until his untimely suicide in the February of 1912. To hear more about Dr. Moore's story, please listen to our previous podcast episode about the Buffalo Park Sanatorium and the strange death of Dr. William Moore.
All right, so our word for today's podcast is suspicious.
Yes, today's story is brought to you by the letter S. For suspicious.
Yeah, you know, like just the old Sesame Street thing where they have like a letter sponsoring the episode for the day. That is us today. Because there's not a single fact in this entire case that you should take at face value. Because the person who committed the crime lies. Mm-hmm. The person who is dead
lies.
And so there's really no truth in between any of this.
Yeah, so if something strikes you as odd or weird, hold on to that feeling.
Yes.
It probably is right.
Yes. I mean, there's truly only one innocent person in this entire story. Mm-hmm. Everybody else has...
There's something going on.
Blood on their hands, basically. Yeah. Yes.
It's, like I said before, this is one of the most convoluted true crime stories we've ever heard, and Anna and I have heard quite a bit of true crime stories in our day.
Yes.
But this just, it just keeps going.
Yes. You think it's done, and it's not.
It's never done, really.
So let's set the scene. What exactly is the Kinnamer murder? So we're going to go all the way back to Tulsa on November 30th, 1934. It's Thanksgiving evening in America, so people gathering around tables, sharing meals, there's some football going on. A young man named John Gorrell Jr., who is a dental student and the son of a prominent Tulsa physician, was eating Thanksgiving dinner with his family on this evening, and all of a sudden, he leaves to go on a date.
You know, just a classic Thanksgiving evening date.
But around midnight that evening, he is found slumped over the steering wheel of his Ford sedan. The car was jammed against the curb at an intersection of Victor Street and Forest Boulevard in the Forest Hills section of Tulsa. And this is near the Philbrook Museum. And the car was actually in such a way that it was blocking half the street. So when people saw the car, they just assumed drunk driver.
Of course.
Like, it's a holiday, they've been out drinking.
They just crashed
their car, and they were just blocking the road. So a witness named Wesley Cunningham sees the car, runs towards it, thinking, I'm going to find someone who's just passed out drunk in the front seat. He opens the door, and he finds a very pale individual sitting in the front seat, and there is blood just all over his face.
Yeah.
So he's thinking at first, okay, like, this is a pretty serious accident. Someone's been injured. However, as he is looking at it, he realizes... something's not right. So Cunningham runs home. He goes to tell his stepfather, who immediately calls the police. The patrolmen show up, and as they move Gorrell back to look at him, they realize He's got a bullet hole in his right temple.
Yes. So the police immediately assess this together, that it's a suicide, and that he had shot himself while the car was in movement, in motion, which is why it had kind of careened over the curb.
Suspicious.
Suspicious! There was even a gun in the car. However, that's when the suicide angle stops.
Stops, yes.
We're done with that at that point, because the gun is tucked neatly into a shoulder holster on the seat beside him. And this is not like a
hip holster. No, yeah.
It's a shoulder.
It's one meant to be concealed under like a jacket. Mm-hmm. So he has a shoulder holster on. Gun is inside the shoulder holster, but it's not even on him. It's like on the seat next to him.
The shoulder holster has been taken off on the seat. The gun's been tucked inside the holster, which means that if he had shot himself while the car was moving, going over the curb, this meant he would have to have put his gun back in the holster on the seat next to him.
And then die.
And then die! It makes no sense.
Makes no sense.
There also are no signs of a struggle. It's just kind of his clothes are still really neat, nicely pressed, but of course are bloodstained. And that is very important. It's a major clue, so remember that?
So when the police officers realized that this is the body of John Grohl Jr., they were immediately suspicious of the possibility of this death being a suicide. This just wasn't adding up. The Grohls were a wealthy, prominent family in Tulsa. And when they turned John's head, they actually found out there was not one gunshot.
Oh, no.
There were two.
Oh, yes.
So suddenly, this is no longer a suicide. This is a murder. And the police decided that they needed to keep this information a secret. They didn't want this to get out because this all happens in a really quick time frame. So the car is found on the street around midnight, and they believe that the murder has taken place 30 minutes before. And we'll tell you why they think that here in just a second. But they think from the time that Wesley Cunningham found him to the time the police showed up is less than 30 minutes. So
yes,
they want to keep the information quiet because they know the killer has to be somewhere in the area.
So with the police sergeants start going to the Gorel home, and they are surprised to find that a Tulsa Daily World reporter has already come to the house and told the family that their son is dead. This happens a lot of times during the 1930s, however. You get these really high-profile crimes, and they need to be broken by the press as quickly as they can so they can sell all these headlines. So this happens a lot where press are releasing that family members have died before the family even knows. This happens with, I think, Leopold and Lowe.
I think Bobby Franks' family knew about it before the police ever showed up.
Yes.
It happened with Elizabeth Short, who is the Black Dahlia, famous murder case from Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Like, her mother gets a telephone call from a newspaper reporter saying, hey, you know your daughter's dead. It's weird by our standards today because the press...
It does feel insensitive.
Yeah, I mean, the press today will keep names out of a newspaper until all the family is notified. So it seems weird to us today. Not weird back then
because all of these newspapers who are very local are in direct competition with each other. And they want to be able to sell a headline that's different than their other competitors. So they're all, you know, racing to talk to these people to get a quote. And even at the expense of, you know, learning that a loved one is dead.
Mm-hmm.
So Dr. Grohl was immediately, one, incredibly distraught, and also really, really angry that this guy had just shown up at his house, and he's like, you know, my son would never kill himself. He was in the best of spirits. I know he wouldn't kill himself. He wasn't the type. The sergeant is able to question the girls about the timeline on their son's day. They say that he had driven into town with his brother because he was actually a dental student from Kansas City, Missouri.
Yes.
So he had a bit of a drive. He reconnected with an old friend named Charles Bard from high school, and then they went to a University of Tulsa football game. Then after that, they went to Thanksgiving dinner with the whole family.
Yeah, so 30 minutes into dinner, there's a phone call.
And this is where we get into suspicion.
It's just, yes. There's a phone call that happens, and John literally shoves his mother out of the way.
Almost knocks her down.
Runs to the phone and is like picking it up and speaking very quickly to whoever's on the other end. And his mother said that he came back to the table and he was looking like nervous and excited. And all of a sudden, John announces that he and Charles have dates.
Yeah, they gotta go.
They gotta go because they got hot dates waiting for them, which is odd.
One could say suspicious.
So they go up to John's room, they get ready, and they leave the house by about 7:20. During this time, John makes another phone call. And then they kind of like walk past the family and guests for Thanksgiving. And when the mother asks, where are you going? John, typical rebel without a cause, Don't ask me, mother.
You can feel the eye roll.
Yes.
In that.
And then, of course, by midnight, he's found dead. So what happens between 7:30 and midnight?
Yes. So at this point, there is a big time gap that the police do not know where John went. So they go to speak to his friend Charles, who was with him. And Charles had no idea what had happened to his friend.
No, he was shocked.
It took like an hour to get him to calm down and actually talk about what happened. So he goes through his day, very emotional with the police, but he says that he had indeed met up with John. They went to the football game and he came to Thanksgiving dinner because John had invited him. And then they actually did leave to go on dates. As weird as it sounds, they actually did have dates. And the phone call he made right before leaving the house was to his date to let her know that she would be
picked up. Yeah. At 7:30. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so he's like, I'm on my way. I'm coming. I'll be there in 10 minutes. And then John just leaves Charles at his parents' house.
In, like, the foyer of the house.
He's like, I have to do an errand before I go pick her up, so I'll be back. You just hang here. At this point, this guy has told you randomly, we're not eating dinner, we're going on dates. And then just leaves you in his foyer.
Yes.
Charles is just there hanging out, and John comes back 30 minutes later with his date, Eunice, and they then drive to Charles's house because Charles has to get ready. They then call Charles's date, Hazel Williams, and as Charles is getting ready, John suddenly has a gun.
How many times does he flash this gun throughout the course
so
of the story?
So many times!
In the course of, what, 5 hours, count how many times John shows people that he has a gun.
Just constantly. And Charles had no idea he had a revolver. So Charles is just like, where did you get the gun? Why do you have the gun? And John is just flashing it around, bragging about it. How cool is it? And then he asks Charles if he has extra cartridges. And Charles is like, of course I don't. What are you talking about? And John's like, oh, it's fine, it's fine. I have 3 cartridges. I'll make it work. Charles is just flabbergasted, but he also kind of just moves on that it's just John's one of funny games.
Yeah, and the theory is that in the 30 minutes that John is gone, he goes and buys a gun.
And buys a gun, because Charles does not recall him ever having
a gun.
A revolver.
Yeah, this
like
was like
this.
Very odd that John suddenly has a gun. On the way to Hazel's house, John shows off his revolver once more. They're just in the car, like, hey!
They're in a moving vehicle, and John is just whipping out this revolver.
He just has this gun.
It said that he was, at one point, drove down the street with the window open, and he just, like, hanging out with the gun.
So once they pick Hazel up, they go back to Charlie's house. So they're just, like, driving all over Tulsa at this point, having a good time.
But they finally, all 4 of them are in
Charlie's house at the same time, yes.
We finally get there.
They're only there for 10 minutes before John announces he has to leave. He has to go see a friend.
Okay.
And so he leaves with Eunice, and Charlie never sees John again. But he has no idea who John is supposed to be meeting. So the police think, okay, we're going to go find Eunice.
Yeah, because all that Charles knew about this friend was that John said this was the only day he could meet his friend. If he didn't meet him then, he was going to miss him and he wouldn't be able to meet up with him ever again.
Yes. So the police find Eunice. Eunice is actually a nursing student at St. John's Hospital. And at that time, nursing students would live and work at the hospital. So they find Eunice, and she says that after they left Charlie's house, the two of them go to a motel for a couple hours. And then they go to a nearby food stand. What food stand is open on Thanksgiving evening of 1934?
I read that from the newspaper and I was so baffled. I have no idea what food stand she even means, but apparently it's just a food stand for those who need to eat around 11 o'clock.
I guess.
In Tulsa on a Thanksgiving night.
John tells Eunice that he really needs to go meet with someone. Mm-hmm. Like, he has to go to this meeting. But she says that they didn't meet this mysterious other person while she was with him. He actually drops her off at St. John's Hospital and leaves her there by 11 o'clock. Suddenly, now it's shortened down. Who did he meet between 11 and midnight? That's what the police are trying to find out now.
Remember that wonderful plan the police had about keeping it all hush-hush, making it a suicide, no one would know? Well, that falls through by the next morning.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Completely falls apart. Because the morning paper announces all about how John Jr. has been murdered, and it said that the reason that the leak was actually from the police chief, that the police chief wasn't aware of the suicide angle and just told the Tulsa Morning News that, oh yeah, he was murdered, and all this information. So it's immediately blasted on the newspaper, and the police are frantic at this point because now the murderer knows that the police know what's going on. So the facts were these, and this is where I'm going to kind of lay all the information out. and we can just kind of put all the cards on the table. So John Gorrell Jr. had been shot with his own gun twice, and this was while the vehicle was moving. The shooter had been could have had to have been sitting in the front seat right beside him, because that is where the gun was found, and it was placed back in its holster. This led the police to believe the shooter would have been someone he possibly could have known and he was at ease with, because his clothes were unruffled and there was no sign of a struggle.
Yes, and this all happens within an hour from 11 p.m. to 12 a.m.
So are you with us so far?
Yes. On December 1st, 2 days after the murder, at 2 p.m., two men enter the Tulsa County Courthouse. There are police there kind of talking about, like, who might have done this, and all of a sudden, these people walk in. The two men were criminal defense attorney A. Flint Moss, who was one of the high-profile defense attorneys in the city of Tulsa, and he has a young man with him. The defense attorney tells the deputy that the man with him was Philip Kinnamer, and he had come to surrender for killing John Gorrell Jr. Now, they know who Phil Kinnamer is.
Oh yeah, everyone in the room is very aware that Phil Kinnamer is
in the building. Yes, who he is. And the reason they know who he is because Phil Kinnamer's father is United States District Judge Franklin E. Kinnamer. And so what does Phil say that he has done? He says that he killed John Gorrell Jr. in self-defense with Gorrell's own gun. And he was just dropped off at the courthouse in front of a slew of journalists. And of course, this provokes a media frenzy because these are two sons from two very prominent Tulsa families.
Yes, and Gorrell's murder and Phil Kinnamer coming and claiming that he had done it in self-defense shined a light on an exclusive club that we know within Tulsa's well-to-do. The children of what we now know as the Nouveau Riche, which were made wealthy by the nation's ever-increasing hunger for oil, were called the High Hat Club. Now that's H-Y, not H-I.
Yes, yeah. Or any other way you spell high. Yes. H-Y-H-A-T.
So if you want to look it up, feel free. It's H-Y.
Yeah, and this was a self-given name.
Oh yeah, they gave this name to themselves. And it was a group of kind of well-to-do off sons and these younger post-debutante daughters who seem to have, you know, the people that have it all. They have good looks, lots of money, they seem to know everyone important, but they also wanted a lot more. For the early 1930s, this was beyond scandalous behavior.
I don't know if I would call this tame by our standards today.
This is really crazy. I was like trying to make them sound not as horrible, but it's still wild.
I mean, to set the scene, like, I was like, this is kind of like Regina George and the Plastics from Mean Girls. But then I got to thinking of an even better comparison is Cruel Intentions.
Oh, yeah.
If you've ever seen the movie Cruel Intentions, this is what this is.
It is. So they drank very heavily, really, you know, high content alcohol. This is not your light Bud Light. They also were driving really, really fast, fancy cars given to them by their parents, mind you. And they all smoke the quote unquote stupefying marijuana weed and other things yet more sinister.
Yes. So let's talk about this High Hat Club. So this is Jay Gatsby.
This is Jay Gatsby living it up.
This is his wild parties. I mean, this is
incredibly drunk, incredibly high, crashing your car in a pool. This is actually happening.
A little party never hurt nobody.
Until we have a dead man in a car.
Yes. So, can you have to think about this club in kind of the form of their initiation ritual. So
it
this
sets
is
the
this
scene.
Is to become a member of the High Hat Club. Number one, you had to be rich. You had to know people. Number two, you had to drink 10 glasses of beer.
Mm-hmm.
You had to hop into your car, and then you had to go drive around a corner at 60 miles an hour.
And this isn't our nice little highways we have now.
This isn't even modern cars.
No, these are
1934 Buicks and Fords. Like, think about that.
On gravel roads.
On gravel roads. So one anonymous high-hatter talks about this to the International News Service during the trial. And he says, quote, "The whole trouble in Tulsa society is this. 40 years ago, these millionaires didn't have a dime. They were workers in the oil fields. Their wives were ordinary girls. Some of them were waitresses and the like. Then comes this flood of oil and gold. They had millions of dollars all of a sudden. They shower money upon money upon money on their children. Too many expensive automobiles. Too much time to do nothing," end quote. And I think we mentioned at this point that you might assume these are people like in their 20s or 30s.
Sure.
Like you assume like later college.
They've graduated college.
Phil Kinnamer is 19 years old.
He's a baby.
Gorrell is 21.
He, like, just turned 21,
yes.
too.
They are teenagers. Yeah. So this is what is happening in Tulsa High Society in 1934.
Four teenagers who are just completely wasted. Kinnamar and Goral were at the center of the things that we talked about being more sinister, performed by the High Hatters. They were bored with the drinking, getting high, driving fast, and after all that, they decided to get a little more crazy and turn to a life of crime.
Yeah, I mean, from what we were reading, Kinnamar was a bad man. Like, yes. He kept running away from home, and his dad kept sending him to military school, and he would run away from military school.
He said he
school.
Wanted to join the French Foreign Legion.
Yeah, at one point. And I think we'll talk about this later again, but yeah, so Kinnamar, like, has a history of being, like, a wayward teenager.
Yeah, and so does Goral. We'll get onto that later on. But so they started to be, you know, petty offenses, like stealing. They started to sell dope. It's actually said that they were, like, smuggling in marijuana from Mexico.
Yeah.
Then they eventually got tired of those too. They were in that, like we said, weird area between high school and college, but they were children of privilege who, honestly, even though they had all this much money, they were still burning through it like crazy.
Yeah, I mean, alcohol costs money. They were high stakes gambling going on. Yeah, so
despite being incredibly wealthy, they also wanted a lot more money, and they decide to do what anyone would do: extortion.
Oh, we're not gonna work for it.
No.
We're going to extort our friends.
Of course. So they tried to get their other rich but not too bright friends into compromising situations. That usually involves sex and then taking incriminating Kodak photos.
They're taking photographs of them in incriminating positions.
Blackmail is not new.
No.
However, this isn't like L.A. or New York where you have a ton of loose girls.
No.
They ran out of girls to photograph very quickly.
I mean, you're still in a very conservative area of the United States. I mean, yeah. Religion is very important here in Oklahoma. So these are girls from well-bred families who don't really get themselves in these compromising situations.
No.
So yeah, they literally burn through their extortion people very quickly.
They do. So these kind of sexual blackmail thing, it runs out pretty quick. So they have to do something else.
So what do they turn to?
You know.
Kidnapping.
Threats of kidnapping.
Kidnapping. So even though these are two men from very wealthy families, one of them comes up with the idea to kidnap one of Tulsa's shining debutantes.
And Kinnamar will swear over and over and over that it was Goral's
idea. And Goral supposedly came up with this idea while he was in college in Kansas City.
Yes.
So, you know, between studies, he just comes up with this plot to kidnap someone.
If you want to believe Kinnamar, you can, but he's the one that says over and over, Goral did this, Goral wanted to do this.
Unfortunately, the target that Goral chooses is a pretty young woman that Kinnamar is infatuated with.
Yes.
Like, this is the love of Kinnamar's life. The evidence surrounding this crime reveals a plot that involved both of them. In a statement given to police only hours before Kinnamar turned himself in, they learned that the two had planned to extort $20,000 from a wealthy Tulsa oil businessman named H.F. Wilcox. And the plan was to kidnap and or kill his 18-year-old daughter, Virginia.
And we actually do have the note.
Oh, we have the note. This note is, like, written by a 12-year-old.
You can really tell how young they are.
Yes. So this is the note that never got delivered to Wilcox, I don't believe.
No.
But they found it, and this is what it says. It says, "Sir, you will secure $20,000 in bills of the following amounts." Now, when I say the amounts, it is written in both numerical and longhand.
Yeah,
so it's literally like $20,000 in numbers, and then it's like in parentheses, this much written out.
In case you couldn't tell.
Yes.
We want
$20,000. $20,000. $10,000 in $5 bills, $5,000 in $10 bills, and $5,000 in $1 bills. Dot, 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 dot.
It's like 15 ellipses.
15 dots. Failure to comply with our demands will result in certain and painful, quote, death.
In all caps.
In all caps. For one or more of your children. So Wilcox has multiple children. I think he has four kids.
I
can't remember, but he has at least four children. Yours in expectation, John Doe. Symbol. This is HFW speaking. So when they called the house for the extortion, once they kidnapped Virginia, when he picked up the phone, he was to say to them, this is HFW speaking. It also goes on to say, strict silence, even in your family, must be observed.
Yes.
So when Wilcox gets this note, he's not to tell anybody, not even his own family members.
Right. And what happens is Goral gives Kinnamar this note to mail, and Kinnamar freaks out and refuses. And he says he has this big plan that he's just going to kill Goral before he hurts Virginia.
So, but was he really in love with Virginia?
No. I mean, I can't say for him, but I feel like he was way more obsessed.
It's an obsession, yes.
Than love, because this love was not reciprocated. It's not that he and Virginia were going steady in love with each other. They had gone on a couple of dates, and Virginia was not a part of the High Cat crowd. She dated him 4 or 5 times, and she would say that she didn't really like him. They went on a couple of dates. She tolerated him. She didn't really call him after
and she
that.
Didn't even know John Goral.
No, she had no idea who he was.
Yeah.
So honestly, she was just kind of like, oh yeah, Phil Kinnamer, oh him. Meanwhile, Kinnamer thinks that the sun and moon revolve around her.
Yeah, like they're getting married, basically. And Virginia was really smart. She was very rich. She was very confident. And like when you see pictures of her, you're just like, oh
yeah.
Like she's beautiful. She just knew that she was going to do better than Kinnamer.
Of course. I mean, it's not really that hard to know.
So the main witness statement in this entire case is from an airplane pilot named Floyd J. Huff. And he goes to the chief of detectives, Thomas Higgins, in Kansas City, Missouri, and says he knows who killed John Goral Jr. He had known Goral. Goral is actually a pilot, licensed pilot. And Goral had come to rent a plane with a friend. And this friend is Kinnamer.
Yes.
On November 21st. However, he didn't know Kinnamer by the name Kinnamer.
No.
Like, Kinnamer is just going by different names.
Kinnamer continues to use fake names the entire time.
Yes. And this all happens on November 21st. So, what, 9 days?
It's 9 days before.
Yeah, 9 days before the murder. However, due to weather conditions of the day, they couldn't fly the plane. So, Kinnamer doesn't even take his flight from Kansas City back to Tulsa. And he asks Huff for a ride. Now, during the trip, they're drinking. Kinnamer tells Huff that he had come to Kansas City to kill John Goral.
He's telling everyone
what
he wants
to do. Yes,
he
tells everybody this. Like, random people he will walk up to and be like, hey, guess what? I'm going to kill John Goral.
Yes.
So he says that he's going to get Goral up in the plane, hit Goral over the head with a wrench, and then parachute to safety to make it seem like an accident. So he's going to let the plane crash.
He is.
And then that's going to destroy all of the evidence. Huff doesn't believe him.
No, he calls him out. He's like, listen, kid, you're drunk. You're crazy.
He doesn't believe him. So what does Kinnamer do? He pulls out an 8-inch dagger.
And, like, threatens the guy.
And threatens the guy.
He's like, believe me, I'm gonna kill this man.
Yes, and he's super disappointed, and he tells Huff that he would have killed Goral, and he's going to kill Goral when he comes home for Thanksgiving. And he plans to drive him out to some lonely road, pretend to have a flat tire, and then stab him.
Yes.
So it's supposed to be a stabbing, not a shooting.
Which is interesting. So Kinnamer, of course, then shows Huff the extortion note. And he said that the letter was given to him by Goral, and he just couldn't actually mail it. And they went to Wilcox to actually repeat, to confirm the story and ask if Wilcox had ever received the
Wilcox
note.
Yeah, Wilcox has no idea what's going on.
No, Wilcox is like, I have no idea. I never actually received the note, which proves that Kinnamer didn't actually send it. But then they're waiting for other families to come forward with the extortion plots. And the Tulsa Tribune was the first newspaper to break the story that Kinnamer actually killed John over the extortion plot. So this is where Kinnamer says that it was organized by John and not him.
The statements of various witnesses continued to pour in from acquaintances and friends, and they were either released to the police or recited by these witnesses directly to the Tulsa World. So that's how they are getting this information. Mm-hmm. Kinnamer actually gave an interview himself to the World on the day he surrendered. These statements, along with evidence offered at Kinnamer's trial, established that Goral and Kinnamer may have been involved in other activities as well, including robbery, hijacking. We definitely know about the dope smuggling.
They were smuggling dope.
They were smuggling dope. And this painted just this picture of these two young men drinking, gambling, and they were potentially violent.
Yes. So this is what Kinnamer says to everyone. This is his statement. He says that Goral, who was attending Kansas City Dental College, had given him the note. And this is when Kinnamer was supposed to mail it, and he couldn't. He was in love with Virginia. He couldn't hurt her. So he asks to meet at 11 p.m. So this is where Kinnamer says Goral is at 11 p.m.
Yes. He says he confronted Goral with the note, so he doesn't mail it. He's like, "This, I still have it."
He, like, shoves it in his face.
Yeah, and he told Goral that if he ever harmed Virginia Wilcox or her family, he was going to take it to the police. So tables are turned!
Yes.
We're extorting each other now! According to Kinnamer's version of the events, Goral pulled the pistol on him and aimed it at Kinnamer. So we don't know why Goral gets the gun. He has really no rhyme or reason to have it. He just goes and buys this gun. So maybe he kind of felt like something was going wrong. I think he knew
something was brewing.
Goral pulls the pistol, aims it at Kinnamer. This guy's been flashing this gun around all night, doesn't know how to use it.
No.
Because when he pulls the trigger, the gun misfires. So they get into a wrestling match with the gun in the front seat of the cart. And it's a violent struggle, according to Kinnamer. And during the struggle, the gun goes off twice and he shoots Goral in the head. Kinnamer then walks to the Owl Tavern, which is kind of like where the Hi-Hat Club was kind based. Kind of like
their local bar. Yeah.
He obtained a ride to his parents' house after that. Now, he didn't turn himself in for 2 days because he claimed, quote, "I was crazy with worry and didn't know what to do," end quote. Kinnamer makes this assertion in spite of stopping off for a casual cup of coffee with a friend and then going hunting with his father in Rogers County, Oklahoma the next day.
Yes.
So he's crazy with worry, but he's out having, like, coffee with friends and hunting with his dad.
Yes, and what Anna just described was how Kinnamer said it went down.
Yes.
And if it feels weird, hold on to that feeling.
Yes.
To further sensationalize what happened, Sidney Bourne Jr., who is the president of the Hi-Hat Club, is found dead. Yeah, two weeks later. 2 weeks later, after Goral's death, he is found dead. Also in a car, I'm pretty sure. His death was pronounced as a suicide, but Kinnamer contended that he had been killed to suppress his testimony that would have helped to exonerate Kinnamer.
Yeah, and we don't really know...
We have no idea.
...what he saw, what he knew. Supposedly he was an eyewitness. So we have no idea what he was going to tell the lawyers, the jurors, any of that.
No. And at this point, the three highest members of the Hi-Hat Club are either dead or on trial for murder.
Nor do we really know who Kinnamer thought might have killed him.
No, it doesn't really
make... He just says he was killed.
Yeah.
Don't know who.
No idea. But at this point, the club is disbanded.
Yeah, they're gone.
So you have a very high-profile crime involving the son of a judge, the son of a wealthy family, and the daughter of an oil baron. And if you're in this defense trial... I mean, everyone knows these people. You have to get out of Tulsa. You can't be there. There's no way that anyone could come in unbiased. So they decide to choose a new venue.
You're choosing a new venue. Where do you go?
Why not a sleepy little town? A town
named Pawnee, Oklahoma.
Sure.
So due to the mass hysteria around this case, which was dubbed the, quote, society gang killing. And again, this is national news.
Yes.
It's not just some little podunk town. This is high profile, big news story. The trial was moved to Pawnee, Oklahoma. Now, why did they choose Pawnee? We had a brand new, shiny courthouse.
Yes.
The county courthouse, which is still there today, had just finished construction, and it cost about $100,000, and it was ready for the crime of the century. Here in Pawnee, Kinnamer was actually treated like a normal prisoner. Now, this is something you run into a lot with this case, is that he was given special treatment.
It said that he was really treated very well in the Tulsa prisons,
yeah.
And when he got to Pawnee, it was kind of a shock to the system.
He was a normal prisoner here in Pawnee. He was in a cell, treated just like the other prisoners.
People said in Tulsa he got like hour-long breaks just to walk around and all this stuff, and when he got to Pawnee, that all stopped.
Yes, and the 12 jurors, who unfortunately I couldn't find their names, we found the Tulsa World article, but we couldn't actually read it. The 12 jurors were like local farmers from around the area, so they were not in high society, they were not connected to anybody, they were like farmers.
They weren't impressed.
No, they were not impressed. The people in Pawnee did not care for Kinnamer.
No.
They didn't like that he was a judge's son. They didn't care that he had money. So, yeah, they could...
They did care that he had shot someone.
Yes, they did, because they would ring the courthouse square with signs that said, "You are guilty!" exclamation point. These were hung from buildings, and he had to look out of the courthouse to see them. And there's actually a picture on our Facebook page of him looking out the courthouse window, and the sign is on a building just across the way. I mean, this is what's facing him in Pawnee. This trial was also the reason why the Pawnee County Courthouse got both telephone service and telegraph service. There's a really cool picture of people unloading this huge telegraph machine off the back of a truck. And the reason for that was because news had to travel fast, and the courthouse had to be equipped to accommodate that. So it was completely state of the art because of the Kinnamer trial.
Right. So we've given you a lot of information, but let me recap some evidence for you. Remember earlier when we told you that Goral's clothing wasn't disturbed, it was all nice and put together? Well, that physical evidence did not support Kinnamer's story of self-defense at all. There was no evidence they had struggled over each other with the gun, there was no evidence they had gotten in a fight, so his self-defense claim kind of falls out very, very quickly.
Yes.
But he still was shot twice in the head with a .32 caliber pistol. There were no signs of a struggle. The gun itself was on still in the seat next to Goral in the holster. Does that really sound like a struggle to you?
No.
No, it sounds suspicious. Kenimer professed that he loved the intended victim, Virginia Wilcox, and he claimed he had killed Gorl to preserve her safety. We have a ton of stories, however, that go against the self-defense claim, because Kenimer told literally everyone he knew he was going to kill Gorl. He told the pilot, he told his friends, he told them at a bar one day. He's literally walking around saying, I'm going to kill Gorl, which honestly to me smacks way more of premeditated murder.
Yeah, it's almost like he was planning to do a stabbing, because he has the dagger, we know that, and it was just kind of an opportunity that he took that suddenly there was a gun.
Yes.
So whether or not Gorl took the harness off and had it, like, on the seat beside him when Kenimer got into the car, we don't know.
It kind of gets somehow fuzzy.
The holster gets off, is on the car, and Kenimer must have seen it and just kind of took the opportunity to use that weapon instead.
Right.
The lawyers knew they couldn't win this trial because of the evidence. Like, it was just a mountain of evidence. Suddenly, self-defense wasn't even on the table anymore, and everyone in the High Cat Club knew about this plot. Now, by the time of the trial, the defense had to come up with something else because, again, self-defense is not on the table anymore.
No, it's fallen apart.
So what do? They come up with an insanity plea. So this is actually one of the first trials in America where psychiatrists were brought in to testify on the stand about how mental illness or temporary insanity might play a part in a crime. Now, insanity pleas are not unusual. Like, that happened a lot. Now, yeah. Well, even back then, like, even in the 1800s, like, you could say, well, I was insane, you know, that's why I did this. But this is, like, the first time that they have a psychiatrist on the stand testifying that this young man was temporarily insane.
Well, both the defense and the prosecution used them. They had the prosecution brought in an alienist and was like, no.
So the defense used several prominent physicians, including a Dr. Menninger, who was the foremost American psychiatrist at the time. Even Kenimer's father portrayed his son as mentally disturbed and incapable of knowing right from wrong. Again, he was a wayward kid. He ran away from home constantly. He was in military schools. Nothing was straightening him out. So his father testifies like, yes, I acknowledge my son has issues.
And the prosecution kind of wasn't really having it. So the prosecution established the facts of the killing. They said, you know, all of the stuff had gone down. They called a witness who indicated that Kenimer had threatened Gorl's life repeatedly. This included Huff, as well as Randall, B.B. Morton, and Richard Oliver. On the night he killed Gorl, Kenimer was apparently drinking with friends at the Owl Tavern, and Kenimer displayed the knife. He told Randall that he was going to use it to kill Gorl, and Morton was kind of trying to take the knife away from Kenimer, because at this point, Kenimer was kind of freaking him out. And Kenimer still left without his knife, intent on meeting with Gorl and meeting him with him about the extortion plot.
Yeah, there's some kind of weird stuff about the knife, too, because Huff says it's a dagger. It's an 8-inch dagger. His friends say, no, he had a hunting knife.
Yeah.
So there's a difference between those
two. Very different.
So, like, they all say that he had a knife, but there's some discrepancy as to what kind of knife it actually was.
And this is where I think that Gorl had to have known what's coming.
All of these people are trying to stop him from doing this.
Yeah.
Somebody has to have picked up the phone and said, hey.
Yes.
This guy is trying to kill you.
Exactly.
Gorl's roommate at the Kansas City Dental College, Richard Oliver, said Gorl introduced him to Kenimer. Again, who's going by a false name.
Yes.
He's going by the name Bob Wilson.
Okay.
As you do. Which is suspicious.
It's like the fakest of fake names I've ever heard.
Yeah. So, I mean, and for Gorl to let him use a fake name, that's also very odd.
Very weird.
Oliver testified that Gorl tells him, quote, when this fellow comes in, I want you to look at him and notice him so that when you see him again, you'll be able to recognize him. Because if I ever get killed and murdered, that will be the fellow that did it.
Gorl had to have known he was in danger.
I mean, whether it be from the extortion plot or from their dope smuggling, like, something is going on that Gorl knows Kenimer is out to get him.
Right.
So to discredit Kenimer's claim of self-defense, the state calls an expert witness who testified that the two shots to Gorl's head occurred at least 1 minute apart.
Mm-hmm.
Expert witnesses referred to as alienists, a term used at the time for doctors dealing with mental health, offered opinions on behalf of the state that Kenimer was not insane at the time of the crime.
No.
So it kind of seems to me like a moment of opportunity presented itself. He sees this gun there. Guns less messy, less difficult to do than a knife. So he picks up the gun or gets it away from Gorl in some way. So if Gorl's threatening him, gets it away from him, picks it up out of the holster, shoots Gorl the first time, waits a minute, shoots him again, makes sure the deed is done, puts the gun back in the holster, and then just walks away.
And I can see where he would like, in his messed up brain, I can see where he would think that'd be self-defense, because he's defending Virginia.
Virginia, yeah.
But at the same time, it's not self-defense in any way. It is murder.
No, and again, I mean, they're in their neighborhood.
Yeah.
This is in the neighborhood where these people live. So again, he does this, he walks to the tavern.
Gets a drink,
gets a ride home, and then just goes about his day after that.
Yeah.
Gets some sleep, goes out for coffee, goes out with his dad. So yeah, it's this very odd, like, turn of events.
And it's Kinnamer's personality that kind of was the highlight of the trial, because he asserted that it was self-defense. He gets on the stand after they've thrown that all away and still says it's self-defense on the stand.
Yeah.
And he said he just spends the whole time trying to paint himself as this hero who was trying to save Wilcox's life. According to the accounts of the trial, Kinnamer didn't really come off as insane or sympathetic, however. He came off as cold, aloof, no remorse for what he had ever done, and the evidence did kind of show that Kinnamer was arrogant and maybe a little bit crazy.
I mean, you should never label someone with a mental illness, but there's obviously something going on with Kinnamer. Like, whether it be, like, a personality disorder or something like that. Like, something is wrong with this man.
Absolutely. We also have statements from his father saying that Kinnamer had several times threatened suicide.
Yeah.
Just because he was so emotionally distraught about several things. Dropping out of school, trying to join the French Foreign Legion. He would just threaten himself and others a lot.
So, again, something is going on. Yes, something is going on. Judge Hurst, who was presiding over the trial, instructed the jury that they could find Kinnamer guilty of murder or first degree manslaughter. So those are their two choices. Mm-hmm. The prosecution obviously is going to argue for a murder verdict, and they wanted a penalty of life imprisonment. After deliberations, the jury returns with, wait for it, a verdict of first degree manslaughter.
They go with manslaughter.
Should have been murder.
I don't know how they got manslaughter, but they did.
They agreed to this verdict of manslaughter, but they decided to leave the sentencing to the judge. All of this evidence against Kinnamer, there's an extortion plot, there's murder, they've been in all these illegal activities, they come up with manslaughter.
It's an odd turn.
It's an injustice, kind of. Yeah, it's an injustice odd turn for the Gorrell family. So Judge Hurst actually sentenced Kinnamer to 25 years in the state penitentiary. So he gets 25 years in prison. He's 19 years old, so he's going to get out sometime in his 30s or 40s.
Yes.
The defense filed multiple motions, of course, for a new trial. They didn't want this to just remain as it was. And, of course, those were immediately overruled. The defense then appealed to the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals, which, again, affirmed the sentence and conviction. Now, this is also where we think that the picture of Pawneeba was taken.
Yes.
Somewhere, we think, on the courthouse steps here in Pawnee County before he was taken to McAllister for his prison sentence.
It doesn't make a lot of sense for Pawneeville to be in McAllister.
No, like, there's a couple of things that we think might have happened. We don't think he probably ever went to the trial. That would be odd if he did. There is the possibility that he knew the Kinnamers, but again, that's kind of like a long shot. We have no evidence of that. We probably think that he was down at the courthouse for some kind of business, whether it be for the ranch, paying taxes, doing something, and he just happened to run into Philip Kinnamer.
Yes. That's the story we like to stick with.
Yes.
And it makes the most logical sense in our heads. However, the Kinnamer story does not end with his conviction.
No, you thought we were at the end.
We have more.
You thought, you know, maybe I'll, you know, just serve out my 25 years and get out. And No.
Kinnamer is so upset. He feels so attacked by having to go to jail. So he tries to get pardons from three different governors. And he tries over and over, over. He eventually, in 1938, a couple of years after, was granted a 6-month parole to spend time with his mother, who was dying. However, that kind of got loose, and he immediately got shut back to jail.
Yes, because people were like, why are you giving him special treatment?
They did think it was special treatment. Mm-hmm. The appeals court upheld his conviction again, and the state Supreme Court decided they were done with this case. He was going back to jail. They were sick of him trying to appeal. They were done.
So again, does he just serve out the rest of his sentence? Does he fade into obscurity?
That wouldn't fit with this story.
No, because the final chapter of this story is probably crazier than the rest of everything else that we've already said. So, what happens in September of 1939, Hannah?
I don't know, Anna. Why don't you tell me?
Well, Adolf Hitler invades Poland.
Oh, yeah, that.
Thus beginning World War II.
Yeah, World War II happens.
So, instead of letting able-bodied young men just rot in jail, the government started offering these men paroles on the stipulation that when you are paroled, you join the army.
It was a It was honestly, it sounds very strange, but it happened, it was a very, very widespread tactic. They had to just get bodies to, yeah. To join the war effort.
Yeah, I mean, even though we didn't join the war until December of 1941, of course, Pearl Harbor, it had been going on in Europe since September of 1939.
A lot of jailers thought that it would give them a clean slate. Like, yes. Joining the army, having all this, it would turn them around.
Yes. So in 1943, 6 years after the trial had ended and 6 years that he's been in jail, Philip Kinnamer was given a parole with the stipulation that he joined the army. Governor Robert S. Kerr personally signed the parole, and Kinnamer was off to fight for his country.
Yes, he was.
Again, remember, he wanted to join the French Foreign Legion, so a military career...
Is this his dream?
Yeah, a military career is, like, right up his alley. So, yeah, he's released and he immediately joins.
He becomes a paratrooper in the military, and he was sent off to fight in France. He finally got the opportunity to jump out of airplanes. Yeah. So, hey, another dream.
Yeah, he loves this. Like, this is his best life.
Yes, he absolutely loved it. However, he is serving in Normandy.
Yes.
So he just so happens to get released, sent to France, Normandy happens. And we do have reports of him being there on D-Day. So on August 14th, 1944, Phil was kind of having, at this point, an existential crisis. He was discussing his beliefs with the afterlife, with the friend, and he confided to his friend that he did not believe in God. He didn't believe much of anything. And the friend asked, well, what do you mean that you think if you get shot tomorrow, it's just all over? And he said, yep, that's what I think.
Foreshadowing.
Aww. A lot of foreshadowing.
A lot of
he's
foreshadowing.
Also a murderer. Like, I do want to, like, you do he feel is. Bad for Phil, but he's a murderer.
However, on August 15th, 1944, in Trans-en-Provence, France, Kinnamer and his company were pinned down by German machine gun fire. So they had jumped into Trans-en-Provence, so they had parachuted in, and immediately were pinned down by German troops.
Rapid gunfire.
Phil and another man, Lieutenant Harry Moore, volunteered to eliminate the position, which meant they were going to basically sacrifice themselves. They were going to run forward and take out the gunners. And they were both immediately gunned down by automatic gunfire and killed. So the night after he tells his friend about his beliefs in the afterlife...
Killed.
He's killed. So this friend that he had confided to was named Milton Rogers, and he would write, quote, Lieutenant Roberts came with information that they had just been killed. I got down the line a ways, and there they lie. Phil had a nice row of bleeding holes, maybe 4 or 5 across his chest. It had been maybe 7 or 8 hours since we had been talking about such matters. He then knew more about the hereafter than I did. His death closed the books on one of the country's most publicized slayings, the Thanksgiving shooting of socially prominent John F. Gorel. He had confided to a newsman at the time of his parole that, quote, something just tells me that I won't come back, end quote. He said, I hope that if I die under the flag of my country, those who have condemned me will hold me differently in their memories.
Yes, so he finally gets parole. He's out for a year and gets gunned down. I don't know, you know, I've been struggling with it. It's like, should he just have stayed in jail and waited? But I just don't feel like that's his personality.
No.
It's really not who
no.
he is.
No, again, like, this was, the military was his dream. Like, French Foreign Legion, fighting in a war. I don't know if it was just a romantic image to him, because he had been running away from military schools almost his entire
childhood.
I think
he liked the idea of it.
He likes the idea of it, but... From all accounts, like, he was a good soldier.
Yeah.
Like, he was a good soldier. He loved being a paratrooper. There's multiple pictures of him out there in military. He's happy. He's smiling. He's getting awards. So, I mean, maybe this was, like, his saving grace, like, joining the military.
Yeah, he got a year of it. And there is a memorial for PFC Philip Kinnamer, Jacques Debray, and Second Lieutenant Harris Moore in the Trans-en-Provence in France. He was brought back to Tulsa, Oklahoma, where he was buried in Memorial Park Cemetery. And if
now,
you want
yeah.
one last weird thing about
yes.
this case.
Okay, so if you know Memorial Park Cemetery, it's like the largest cemetery in Tulsa. This is kind of odd, kind of not, but yeah.
You have both Bourne, who was said to have been killed to stop his testimony.
Suicide.
Maybe
killed. Yes.
We're not sure on that. You have Gorel, who was murdered, and you have Phil Kinnamer, who was killed after parole. They are all buried
in the
same
cemetery.
Cemetery.
They all share a cemetery.
And I just feel like that's a really good ending for a really weird case.
Yeah. Now, if you want to know about, like, Virginia Wilcox, she, like, went on to have a family. She died in the early 2000s, I believe.
But we saw 2007?
Yeah. 2007, I believe. Yeah. But she's not buried in Memorial Park Cemetery. She is buried in Tulsa, but not in Memorial Park Cemetery. But that is the strange case of the Hi Hat Club killing, the Society Gang killing, or even the Kinnamer murder.
And that is why we have a weird photo a Pawneeville with Phil Kinnamer.
With Phil Kinnamer. So that will end the Pawneeville Ranch podcast. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Anna Davis, historical interpreter.
And I'm Hannah Wilson, Pawneeville intern. Thank y'all so much for listening.
The Pawneeville Ranch is owned and operated by the Oklahoma Historical Society. For more information, go to www.pawneevilleranch.com. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at Pawneeville Ranch or on Facebook under Pawneeville Ranch and Museum.